radio audience. We're gathered together here on a lovely Wednesday evening, 23rd May 2012, and we have a rather different speaker tonight. For the past three seminars in this series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies, our speakers have been either in anthropology or in history. Tonight we have something different for you. We have a paper in the philosophy of law. And we welcome Dr. Jean-Paul De Luca of the philosophy department at Junior College. He teaches philosophy at Junior College, and he teaches political theory and philosophy of law in the philosophy department of the University of Malta. And the title of his talk is At Loggerheads or in Dovetails? Question: The Individual and the State from Early Modern Jurisprudence to Contemporary International Jurisprudence. And he's especially going to be talking about the role of Francisco Suarez, one of the founding fathers of international law, who played a key role in the emergence of international law and in the development of the philosophy of law in the 16th and early 17th century. So, welcome, Jean-Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul, first of all, for the invitation and for the introduction. I should say, by way of initial disclaimer, that I'm not an expert on Francisco Suarez, though I have studied some of his works in relation to my doctoral research on a contemporary of his, Tommaso Campanella, and I'm not an expert in international law either. My interest is in early modern intellectual history, the history of ideas, that is, and in political and legal philosophy. And what I'd like to do in this talk, in this paper, is to link these interests and to trace a historical pathway which could serve as a basis for analyzing the philosophical underpinning of present-day concerns and possible future directions. Of course, a work in progress seminar is quite helpful and fitting an environment for such explorations. I'm not presenting something which I've already published or worked on extensively. So this is more of a beginning, a work in progress, really. Just one word about methodology. What I'm trying to do, at least in part, is to draw more closely together two broad traditions which have often and ostensibly been kept apart in philosophy, the so-called analytic tradition and the historical tradition. In relatively recent years, a good number of philosophers from both traditions have been wise enough, at least in my opinion, to try and favor this methodological rapprochement. One such philosopher, coming mainly from the analytic tradition, John Cottingham, who does not suffer from the storiophobia that affects many of his colleagues in that field, has argued that, and I quote, philosophical argument does not spring out of nowhere, but is part of a cultural tradition that delivered us to where we are today. And if we ignore that tradition, we will lack full awareness of the significance of the philosophical moves we make with potentially disastrous results. I'm saying this because I do want to justify more or less at the beginning why in the next hour or so I'll be going from an early modern philosopher such as Suarez to a very recent case before the International Court of Justice. In fact, the trajectory, the historical trajectory I'd like to take to trace today spans for centuries from 1612, when the Jesuit philosopher Francisco Suarez published his Tractatus de Legibus, and I'm taking this also as a commemoration of that important work, right up to a few months ago when a case concerning the immunities of states was heard before the International Court of Justice. Now, of course, most of this historical trajectory will be traced in fairly broad strokes, and I will focus on these two important moments, 400 years apart, first of all to, as I said, commemorate Suarez and his contribution to the developments in international law, though I will argue that depicting him as one of the founding fathers of international law is only partially correct, and I say this to his credit. And secondly, to explore some possible openings for the future of international law through a more synchronic reading of Suarez and other theorists of the Insurgentium, who today I'll just mention in passing, and recent developments. Through this method, I hope to bring to light the importance of revisiting early modern texts in order to address the contentious question set as the title of this paper, the role of states and individuals in international law. So let's start from what is more recent, from what is closer to us. The ICJ case, which constitutes a case study par excellence of at least some of the issues I'd like to raise. In this case, concerning the jurisdictional immunities of the states, which was heard before the ICJ between December 2008 and February of this year, 2012, Germany opposed Italy on a matter that traces its origins to the Second World War. In 1944, soldiers belonging to the German Waffen-SS killed 218 men, women and children in the village of Distomo in Greece in retaliation against partisan resistance. Now, recognizing that the Distomo massacre constituted a serious violation of human rights and international humanitarian law, the Greek courts had decided that the Federal Republic of Germany should pay a total of 28 million euros in compensation to the families of the victims of the massacre. However, due to certain procedural provisions in Greek civil law, this judgment could not be enforced. The decision of the court could not be enforced. In view of this, and after earlier claims were rejected by German courts as well as by the European Court of Human Rights, the Greek individuals concerned sought the recognition and enforcement of the Greek court's decision in Italy, which had just awarded compensation to Italian victims of German occupation. So in other words, the Greek individuals went to Italian courts to get what the Greek courts had already decided, but could not enforce within Greek territory. The Greek victim's family so sought and obtained the enforceability of the decision, granting them civil claim damages against Germany, breaches of human rights, and the court awarded them damages in November 2008 in the form of a villa which belonged to the German state organization. Now, Germany appealed against this decision, first in Italy, claiming state immunity, but the Italian courts rejected this argument. So, in December 2008, the Federal Republic of Germany instituted proceedings before the ICJ against the enforceability of the Italian court's decision. In the judgment handed down on the 3rd of February of this year, a majority of judges voted in favor of Germany's claim that the lawsuit did not fall under the competence of Italian courts, and that therefore their ruling on this matter amounted to an infringement of Germany's sovereign rights and immunities under international law. Now, of course, my focus here will not be on the merits of the case itself, but rather what I'd like to do is to take the cue from a number of points raised by a particular judge Cansado Trindade, one of the sitting judges in the court, in two separate submissions he made during the proceedings. First, in a separate opinion, during part of the proceedings, the court was asked to take a decision to take an order on the admissibility of Greece intervening in the case. And in the dissenting opinion, which then eventually accompanied the final judgment. Let's start with the first one. On the 13th of January of 2011, Greece applied to the court for permission to intervene, stating clearly that it was not doing so as a litigating party in the case, but simply in order to inform the court of how a decision of the same court could have affected its legal rights and interests. Since Germany was opposing Italy and the Italian court's enforcement of a previous decision by a Greek court. Now, when Greece made this application, Italy stated immediately that it had no objections to Greece intervening. Germany, on the other hand, asserted that it did not formally object to it, but it pointed out that the application substantially contradicted the grounds of Greece's purported intervention under Article 62 of the ICJ statute. Basically, the Article 62 of the ICJ statute simply says that a state has the right to intervene in proceedings when it has a legal interest to do so. It has to apply with the court, and then the court gives a ruling, an order, in order to determine the admissibility or otherwise of that application. What Germany was saying was that while Greece was claiming that the court's judgment would eventually affect its interest as a state, since it related to a Greek judicial body, the Greek courts, Germany argued that the case ultimately concerned the rights of and compensation to individuals, and the two were separate. The ICJ statute allows states to intervene when their legal rights as states are affected, but not individuals. In its order, that is, in its decision on this matter, the court eventually ruled in favor of Greece's application, thus establishing what the judge, Kansalo Trindade, refers to in his separate opinion, motivating his vote in favor of the order, as the resurrectio of intervention in contemporary international litigation. Now, the matter of greatest relevance in this important piece of jurisprudence is that the rights of a state, Greece in this case, were seen to be in consonance with the rights of individuals, in this case, Greek nationals. Both states and individuals were recognized as bearers of rights, but this is not always the case in international jurisprudence. Or to be more precise, international jurisprudence not always puts individual rights at par with those of states. The hierarchy of value sometimes places the rights of states above those of individuals. In fact, in a dissenting opinion in a previous order of the court in the same case, Judge Kansado Trindade had argued that claims as to rights which are inherent to human beings cannot be waived by means of interstate agreements. I'll just quote a piece from this separate opinion. States may, if they so wish, waive claims as to their own rights, but they cannot waive claims for reparation of serious breaches of rights that are not theirs, rights that are inherent to the human person. A purported waiver to this effect runs against the international ordre public, is in breach of the jus cogens. I'll return to the jus cogens, the idea of jus cogens later on. This broad outlook in a higher scale of values is in line with the vision of the so-called founding fathers of the law of nations, the jus gentium. And with what I regard as the most lucid trend of contemporary international legal thinking. Now, among the founding fathers of the law of nations, Judge Kansado Trindade includes a whole list of people, like Francisco de Vittoria, Alberico Gentili, who wrote De Jure Belli, Francisco Suarez, and his De Legibus, Ac Deo Legislatore, Hugo Grotius, who wrote the famous work of on the law of war and peace, Samuel Pufendorf, and Christian Wolff. The judge highlights Suarez's view, in particular, that the law of nations, the jus gentium in other words, discloses the unity and universality of humankind and regulates the states in their relations as members of the universal society. Now, this very short and succinct reference to Suarez in the separate opinion at the International Court of Justice captures the two senses, complementary to one another, of the Doctor Eximius's, Suarez is known as the Doctor Eximius, just like most other medieval and early modern scholars, you know, were given these titles, Doctor something, his idea of the jus gentium. So let me say something about Francisco Suarez before explaining in more detail what these two facets of his idea of the jus gentium are all about. Suarez was born in Granada in 1548, and at the age of 16 or so, he was among 50 young men who asked to join the Jesuits at the famous College of Salamanca. 49 of them were accepted forthrightly, Suarez was rejected because he was considered to be below standard. Eventually, an exception was made to accept him provisionally. He struggled in his study of philosophy. At one point he was called a dumb ox. Of course, not exactly a nice appellative. It didn't bode well had it not been used a couple of centuries earlier to describe Thomas Aquinas. Suarez took his studies very seriously and eventually excelled in philosophy and soon moved on to theology, in which he was really a master. In the history of philosophy, he is known also for his contribution to metaphysics. His Relaciones Metaphysicae, which were written towards the end of the 1500s, were quite influential, especially when it comes to the principle of individuation and the influence that had on philosophers like Leibniz, for example. He held a number of lectureships in both philosophy and theology in Spain until he was transferred to Rome to take up one of the most prestigious academic positions in the Society of Jesus, that of professor at the Collegium Romanum, the chair of theology at the Collegium Romanum. After 5 years, for a number of reasons which I won't go into, he was back in Spain and he taught at various universities there, first at Alcalá, then at Coimbra, and later at Salamanca. During his first stay at Salamanca, the rector of the university asked Suarez, who seems to have been an excellent scholar, but not exactly a very good orator, to teach a course on law. And the course was printed in 1612 as the Tractatus De Legibus Agreo Legislatore, which is why we're commemorating the 400th anniversary since its publication this year. Now, this dealt with the subjects which were discussed by predecessors of Suarez, including his predecessor at Salamanca, Francisco de Vitoria, one of the most important early figures in the development of what eventually became international law, and also his contemporaries such as Domingo de Soto and the Jesuit Luis de Molina. All of these made very important contributions to early modern legal thinking. The Tractatus de Legibus is divided into 10 books. I'm just saying this as an introduction. It follows the typical scholastic method of structuring the subject around a series of successive and conceptually related questiones and responsiones, starting with the meaning of the word law and the nature of the concept through to its various kinds and subdivisions. Suarez was a natural law theorist who drew his ideas primarily from Aquinas, but also from the long tradition that preceded him. This included the corpus of Roman law, in particular the Justinian's Code of Civil Law, and other important authors such as Isidore of Seville, the author of the famous Etymologia, which has an important section on law. In many ways, and not only in his philosophy of law, Suarez can be referred to as an independent Thomist. So he largely follows on the lines of Aquinas, but like many others in the 16th century, he either tries integrating the classical Thomistic concepts with later developments. He tries ironing out certain controversies, philosophical controversies that came about in later centuries. For example, in his definition of law, the general definition of law, he moves away from the from Thomas's emphasis on reason. Thomas defined law as an ordinance of reason, an ordinatio rationis. This emphasis is not found in Suarez's definition of law, who describes it as an act of a just and right will by which a superior wills to oblige an inferior to doing this or that. You will notice, of course, that the emphasis here is on the will. Suarez is writing a couple of centuries after the controversy, one of the central questions in medieval philosophy, where, by and large, the two main schools, the Thomists and the Scotists, laid a different emphasis on the relation between the reason and the will. The Thomists followed the view that the reason is supreme over the will, and the Scotists, by and large, took the opposite position. There was a whole process, particularly in the 15th, 16th century, where this dichotomy was to some extent overcome. In his introduction to De Legibus, the philosopher of Granada illustrates a political philosophy whereby political association is, on the one hand, natural, and this follows the Aristotelico-Thomistic concept, but also a result of the will of human beings as free agents who agree or tacitly consent to form such associations. Human societies and political authority, therefore, are in a sense natural, but also arise from the tacit or explicit consent of the people. And this puts them closer to a contractarian model. They choose which form of government and which laws to adopt. This accounts also for both political and legal variety. He then asserts the sovereignty which places each state on an equal level with other states in the exercise of its power. This includes judicial power. A state can make its own laws which cannot be appealed in any court or tribunal outside that state. However, this idea of the sovereignty, of state sovereignty, or the ruler, when the ruler embodies the state, is not absolute, and I'll return to this later on. In fact, in the section concerning positive law in De Legibus, Soares clearly lays the parameters of the limits of state sovereignty and state intervention. Civil authority should not interfere in the private domain of families and individuals, unless in function of the common good or the observance of laws, because by nature, the families and individuals are prior to the state. I'm just quoting freely from what he says. Now, since this is not an overview of, it's not meant to be an overview of Soares's legal theory in general, I'll just limit myself to a brief exposition of the main principles concerning the notion of the jus gentium, so as to tie them up then with the rest of the paper. The part that concerns us most is the second book, where Soares deals with the eternal law, natural law, and the law of peoples. And the jus gentium is discussed in the last four chapters of this book, of the second book of the De Legibus. So, a very vexed question in Thomistic legal theory and early modern natural law theory in general was whether the jus gentium, I'll say later why I'm not translating it as the law of nations or the law of peoples, but I'd rather stick to the Latin term, was whether the jus gentium pertains to the sphere of natural law or positive law. Thomas himself had been ambivalent in the Summa Theologica, in the Prima Secunda, where he deals with the subject of law. There are places where he seems to put the jus gentium under natural law, and elsewhere he puts the jus gentium under positive law. So there's a bit of an ambivalence there, which of course gave rise to various interpretations in later philosophers who followed his theories. Isidore of Seville, who I mentioned before, had emphasized the customary nature of the kind of law. In other words, that this law arises from custom and is not so much based in natural law. Soares refers to it as, and I quote, a quasi-medium between natural and human law, insofar as it follows from, but is not quite as necessary as, natural law. The quasi is significant because later Soares suggests that the character of the jus gentium, in fact, is that of positive human law. What distinguishes the law of or among people, what he refers to as the jus inter gentes, which is common to everyone, from civil law, that is the law of a particular state within a particular jurisdiction, is that the first is customary, while the latter is usually written. The jus gentium then, like positive law, according to this account, still depends on the consent of the people who recognize such principles. Now, Soares speaks of the jus gentium mainly in terms of objective rights rather than subjective rights. In other words, it functions in virtue of an objective good that exists prior to the law, be it written or customary. This kind of law, but declares rather than creates a good that ought to be followed. Whereas civil law actually creates a good, according to his account, the jus gentium simply declares. Now, this is quite interesting. I don't have the time to go into it, even though I'll mention the Universal Declaration on Human Rights later on, that the word declaration there in that document is not a coincidence. I mean, it fits into what someone like Suarez and others, of course, said about the jus gentium, that you have a declaration of something that is there prior to that declaration. In the case of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's not as such a law, but the same thing can apply here to his idea of the jus gentium. Now, the jus, the word jus, jus gentium, can in some cases be understood as the moral faculty pertaining to individuals, such as the right to self-defense, for example. And this brings us to another important element in the legal theory of Suarez, that of subjective rights. Now, Suarez does not use the term subjective rights, but he emphasizes, and he does so more than any other Thomist before him, this important aspect which had already been present in the Thomistic corpus, the relation between the jus gentium and the moral faculty of individuals, that is, individual rights. In the Legibus, Suarez takes time to clarify these two meanings of the word jus. Jus understood as a moral faculty, what we can call a right, for intents and purposes, and jus understood as law. The fact that he does this in the first of the four chapters dealing with the jus gentium is, of course, very telling, since it shows quite clearly that a proper understanding of the concept of jus gentium, of this kind of law, depends heavily on the complementary understanding of these two senses of jus as right and as law. I'll just read a small bit from Suarez. I mean, it's freely translated. Jus sometimes means a moral faculty, that is a right, either for something or over something. Sometimes, however, jus means a law, which is the rule of acting with probity and which establishes a certain fairness in things and is the reason for jus as taken in the first way. Hence, for the sake of brevity, he writes, we may call the first a real right, so jus as a moral faculty, as a right, a real right, and the second, jus as law, a legal right. Now, a real right clearly pertains to the subject and is thus what we may call a subjective right in more contemporary terms, while a legal right, which imposes an obligation of observance, resides outside the subject and may thus be termed an objective right or law. Now, anticipating the dovetail argument I would like to make at the end of this paper, I want to point out very clearly at this point that when he discusses the word jus in jus gentium, Suarez is speaking of two facets of the same word, jus, which he describes as the proper object of justice. And these two facets, in other words, understanding jus as right and as law, should be ultimately closely interlinked. And of course, since he's speaking about the jus gentium, it is clear that in the idea of jus gentium itself, which in some ways later developed into what we would consider today international law, these two elements of law which regulates and obliges, binds, and rights, his respect for individual rights, etc., have to go together. Earlier, I just made a very quick reference to self-defense as a right pertaining to the individual, since Suarez considers this to be the greatest right insofar as it is related to the most fundamental of all rights, that is, the right to life. All other rights, though perhaps less basic, function always as predicates of this fundamental right. As, for example, the right to food, for the preservation of one's body, security, for the preservation of one's property, and so on. Suarez's idea of jus as a natural moral faculty, what I can refer to rather freely as his doctrine of subjective rights, in other words, is not set within the discourse of moral autonomy of the individuals. So it is not the kind of discourse which, for example, is usually associated with someone like Locke or others. But it is very clearly set within the an objective, the discourse on an objective moral order. In other words, natural rights, for Suarez, always emanate from and point towards natural law as an objective moral law which admits no derogation. I will later return to this point in relation to the important principle in international law known as the jus cogens, the set of peremptory norms which admit no derogation. But let me go back to the idea of the jus gentium itself, which I said I'd rather not translate into English since its meaning would be somewhat lost. Just as jus can be translated as either law or right, with both senses being complementary, the word gentium in jus gentium can and has been translated as either of peoples or of nations in English. The thing is that whether we use law of nations or law of peoples or right of nations or right of peoples, we always lose something of the deeper significance of the term. Suarez, like Grotius after him, developed the notion of jus gentium with a very clear intention of attempting to overcome the tension between what we can call Machiavellism, in the sense of the idea where the state is at the apex of the state, like the state of Cesare Borgia, for example, is at the apex of the political process on the one hand, and universal idealism on the other. Universal idealism, which emphasized the unity of humankind through a transcendent conception of legal obligation. In fact, Suarez's notion of the jus gentium is clearly that of a fundamental law, which, unlike civil law, which applies to people within particular boundaries, within a particular jurisdiction, is applicable among persons from different nations insofar as its principles are common to all, or at least many, communities. The jus gentium has its customary origin in the laws which, Suarez says, individual states or kingdoms observe within their own borders. This is what Suarez refers to as the jus gentium intra se, within their own borders. However, and this is the important point, the customary origin in domestic law develops into an understanding of jus gentium inter se, among them, in the sense of that law which all the various peoples, and I'm quoting Suarez, all the various peoples ought to observe in their relations with each other. These are the two facets of his idea of the jus gentium. On the one hand, it regulates states among themselves. On the other hand, it regulates or it declares the rights of all individuals, irrespective of their citizenship or the jurisdiction in which they live. Now, when he speaks of various peoples and the fact that the jus gentium is observed and applies to various peoples, in the Latin text, Suarez uses the words omnes populi et gentes varias. Now, populi, of course, is translated as peoples, which would also presumably be the closest translation in English of gentes, though gentes could also mean communities or groupings of people. But the point here is that it cannot be automatically taken to be a reference to nations or states. Suarez doesn't use, when he's describing the jus gentium, words like naciones or res publica or anything of the sort. So his idea of the jus gentium, taken in this sense, is clearly something that goes beyond the restrictions of either agreements between states or else the declarations of states in their own legal systems. In fact, while maintaining the universality of the jus gentium, so this is the other side of it. On the one hand, there's this universal element in the jus gentium, which he maintains and quite strongly. Yet on the other hand, Suarez also draws important distinctions between the universal natural law and the jus gentium. To then illustrate in the text its affirmative precepts and mandates, its qualified universality, and above all, its status as a human, positive, and customary law that is created by the will of legislators. And of course, this may sound confusing precisely because it shows, it exposes, the inner tension within the idea of the jus gentium. On the one hand, it depends on the declarative force originating in the customary law of many particular jurisdictions, and therefore on the respective legislators. But on the other hand, it transcends the limits of individual states when jus gentium is taken in the sense of binding people to each other, or more so when taken as the law common to the whole of mankind. So I think it's quite clear from what I've just said that although Suarez, and like other theorists of the early modern jus gentium, such as Francisco de Vitoria and his contemporary Tommaso Campanella, tends more towards a positivistic understanding of the jus gentium as separate from natural law, in virtue of the fact that it is also written in the form of covenants and pacts, there is also another sense in which its customary nature reveals the bond with natural and divine law, which is what makes it, as I pointed out earlier, almost a median between natural law and positive law. Now, within the general Thomistic framework to which Suarez and the other scholars of the school of Salamanca, or the second scholastic as they were described, subscribed, human positive law can never transgress or contravene a higher law. Without going into much detail, what seems at first glance to be an ambivalence or even a contradiction with regard to the jus gentium in Suarez actually turns out to be a careful understanding of the fact that some elements of the jus gentium are more closely associated with human positive law, which are expressed in written law, for example, while some other aspects connected more closely to the few basic principles of natural law. While insisting that one ought not to confuse, the verb he uses is confunder, to confuse, one should not confuse natural law and the jus gentium, Suarez is still thinking within the Thomistic framework of a hierarchy of laws, wherein a lower law can never contravene a higher, where a lower law can never contravene a higher law. So just as Thomas and his followers of the natural law tradition would say that positive law can never contravene natural law, the argument Suarez is making is that in this hierarchical structure of law, positive law, a civil law of particular jurisdictions, can never contravene the jus gentium. Whether the jus gentium is understood as an interstate law, one of the basic principles, which is still one of the basic principles in international law today, the pacta sunt servanda, that is that agreements have to be respected, it's the principle of good faith. So whether it's you're understanding the jus gentium as an interstate law, or whether you're understanding the jus gentium as those precepts which emanate from the rights common to all human beings, no positive law, no particular agreement, legal arrangement in a particular jurisdiction can infringe, can go against this idea of jus gentium. I hope that by now it's quite clear why I'm uncomfortable sort of using the term like international law when I'm referring to Suarez, because international law automatically implies the law between nations, whereas it is clear that his understanding of jus gentium goes well beyond nations. It includes nations, but it also includes very clearly individuals. So, and the fact that this brings, because he also says quite clearly that not even the state or its laws, that's an implication of what I just said, not even the state or its laws may violate the rights held by individuals in virtue of the membership of the universal community. And this brings us to the important question of sovereignty in relation to the jus gentium and the rights to individuals. This is also another important theme in early modern legal theory, which was discussed quite extensively by most of the theorists of the time, like Vittoria and Gentili, who I just mentioned, but even, of course, Jean Bodin wrote quite a lot about sovereignty. Grotius dealt with this question and had a particular influence in the development of international law as well. Now, by and large, Suarez is a strong advocate of state sovereignty. But he does not consider sovereignty to be absolute. If we take his theory of subjective rights, what I'm calling subjective rights, as our starting point, we can see that in his De Legibus, Suarez applies this theory to what he considers to be the great question. And this great question is whether subjects have the right to resist or depose a tyrannical ruler, a tyrant. Now, anyone familiar with medieval and modern political theory would know that this was really a vexata question, a big question in political thought. While Thomists after Aquinas more or less relied on classical political theory to advocate the natural base of political authority and to argue in different ways that a ruler who resorts to tyranny is or becomes a usurper of power and may thus be resisted and deposed in virtue of his lost legitimacy or his illegitimacy, modern political theorists like Hobbes and Locke were more inclined to base their argument for resistance on the ruler's failed adherence to the social contract to which he and his subjects were parties. Now, Suarez has been credited, and I pointed this out earlier as well, with offering an early version of the social contract theory, and his views on the right to resist, in fact, are closely related to what we can call his contractarian principle. He doesn't speak of the social contract, but he actually uses terms like the pactum subjectionis, that is, the political contract, and the pactum unionis, the contract of association. Of course, what he does through these two ideas is establish the relationship between the ruler and the ruled, on the one hand, that is the political contract, and also the agreement, the covenant, between the people, the members of that community. So that is the contract of association, the pactum unionis. So there's very clearly, I'm not going to go into this, but there's very clearly a contractarian idea in Suarez, who was writing more or less at the same time as Hobbes, for example. Okay? But his argument on the resistance to tyrants is grounded in what he calls the jus se conservandi, in other words, the right to self-preservation. Subjects may only resist or even depose a ruler in those circumstances where the preservation of the community requires such action. And this is always a form of self-defense. Now, the reason why I'm referring to self-defense is that the right to self-defense advocated for individual subjects is extended in Suarez to states, which, as I said, Suarez describes as natural communities of free persons who choose which form of government to have on the basis of experience, on the basis of good custom, on the needs of the community itself. So, as I said before, the political philosophy of Suarez links the natural basis of the political association, the idea of the man being a social, political being, etc., with the consent and the agreement, the social contract. States, like individual subjects, have the right to defend themselves against external threats to their very existence. And just as individuals may rightfully defend their property and goods as an extension of their right to life, as I pointed out before, so may a state defend its property and territory so as to safeguard its very existence. Justice in domestic or civil law, members of the political community regulate the relations among them, inter se, on matters pertaining to commutative and distributive justice, by means of the jus gentium, taken here as an interstate law. States regulate, through custom as well as through written pacts and agreements, the relations between them. In doing so, individual states establish their own sovereignty and immunity, which is in turn mutually recognized by other states. And it is on this basis, for instance, that the jus gentium as an interstate law establishes the immunity of ambassadors and emissaries, which is something which is still the case in modern international law. Of course, the idea there was not that those persons enjoyed rights as individuals, but as extensions of the sovereignty of the territory of the sending country. So that is sort of the jus gentium in the international sense as interstate sense. However, now if we take the jus gentium in the other sense in which Suarez himself uses it, that is, as the jus in the sense of both law and rights, common to all mankind, then the jus gentium also binds each state to respect the rights held by individuals within it, in virtue of their belonging to the community of mankind. Today we'll call these fundamental rights. So the jus gentium itself at once serves to establish and guarantee the sovereignty and immunity of each state in relation to other states, and to limit the same sovereignty of each state, of the individual state, with respect to those living within it. This is the key idea, I think, in Suarez's idea, notion of the jus gentium, that the jus gentium does both. It establishes and guarantees and safeguards the sovereignty of the state in relation to other states, but it limits that same sovereignty which it establishes in relation to actions of the state affecting individuals within it. This limit to sovereignty and political authority arises also from the consideration that even though an individual is part of the state, the individual retains his status as individual and consequently retains his natural subjective rights. Individuals, and this is very clear in Suarez, individuals are not ontologically absorbed in the notion of the state, and therefore the state, in the exercise of its legitimate sovereignty, may not violate an individual's basic rights, especially, of course, the right to life. At one point, Suarez writes, "The state or its ruler does not own the life of citizens, and therefore it may not lightly or ordinarily compel citizens to lose their lives." So, just as the jus gentium imposes limits on the same state sovereignty which it establishes and guarantees, which is therefore not absolute, it is quite clear to me that in Suarez's system, the jus gentium, understood as interstate agreements, or international law stricto sensu, remains subject to the universal principles of the jus gentium itself, which declare and safeguard the fundamental rights of individuals, which no state can violate. These rights cannot be violated even if states agree among themselves that they may be violated. In fact, while the jus gentium, like modern international law, is based on the principle of good faith I mentioned, that agreements should be observed, the pacta sunt servanda principle, there is also a limit to this principle. And in modern international law, this limit is known as the jus cogens, the compelling law, where there cannot be an agreement between states, which should always, in other cases, be respected, to impinge on the rights, fundamental rights of individuals, for example, to go against human rights of individuals. So even in modern international law, we have this idea of the jus cogens, this set of peremptory norms, which are principles which is, I mean, there's a whole debate about what, how they get to that status, etc., but which international law itself cannot and can never contravene. Now, Francisco Suarez was arguably the first theorist to have sustained in a clear manner the limits to authority on the basis of fundamental principles in interstate law, when it comes to interstate law, which is what later, as I said, became known as the jus cogens. In this sense, he can be seen as a founding father of at least one aspect of modern international law. But I don't think, as I said at the beginning, that it is completely correct to take this description too far. And as I said, this is to Suarez's credit. International law, as it developed in the centuries after his death, moved in a direction quite opposite to the philosopher of Granada's more holistic and dual-faceted understanding of the jus gentium, and I'll explain why. Suarez wrote his De Legibus Ac Deo Legislatore a few years before the beginning of the 30 Years' War, 1648. Now, of course, beyond the religious pretext which seemed to motivate it, this prolonged war involving most European states was nothing less than a series of attempts at territorial expansion, which by consequence challenged the sovereignty of other states. Since the early 16th century, the geopolitics of the old continent had changed considerably, most notably with the rise of the great nations such as France and Spain. I mean, France and Spain were in the 16th century what, you know, what the U.S. and Russia were in the Cold War. This was also the time of the colonization of the Americas, a subject on which Suarez himself and other theorists of the school of Salamanca wrote a great deal. In fact, the treatises on the New World, the Americas, contained much of the groundwork of what later developed into international humanitarian and human rights law. I mentioned Vittoria and his important work, De Indies. Another important author of that period, who is not studied sufficiently, I think, is Bartolomé de las Casas, who wrote a real defense of the atrocities being committed by Spain in the Americas. In Europe, however, while in that kind of in the literature on the Indies, the emphasis was on minority rights, community rights, etc., what we term today as community and minority rights, in Europe, the end of the 30 Years' War, sealed by the Treaty of Westphalia, move things in a very different direction, actually in the opposite direction in some ways. The two main elements of the Treaty of Westphalia were, firstly, the principle that persons in a given state should follow the religion of the ruler, the cuius regio, eius religio principle. Now, of course, I don't really dwell on the effect of this arrangement, but it should be clear that this interstate agreement in the Treaty of Westphalia effectively removed the rights of and liberty of individuals to choose their religion, something which the earlier conception of the jus gentium would have frowned upon. Now, secondly, and this is what I want to focus on, the Treaty of Westphalia established and exalted state sovereignty to the extent of mandating that no state could interfere in the internal affairs of another state. This obviously meant that no state could intervene to defend the rights of, for example, minorities in another state, since they were subject exclusively to the domestic laws of that state. Just to open small brackets, Suarez incidentally had defended the rights of a state to intervene in those cases where it was deemed necessary to defend the rights of minorities or in assisting them in overthrowing a tyrannical ruler. One of his last works, together with De Legibus, is the Defensor Fidei, which he wrote polemically against James I and what was going on in England at the time. But he emphasizes this principle of the right to intervene. Of course, he does so in a very contingent and particular circumstance, and he was no doubt informed by, you know, the whole religious dispute. But that principle he was advocating just before Westphalia was actually effectively removed with the Treaty of Westphalia. And it only re-emerged in international law towards the end of the of the 19th century.
The strengthening of borders through the arrangements of Westphalia had effectively removed the strength of enforceability of individual or minority rights found in the earlier notion of jus gentium, which transcended borders and viewed individuals as primarily citizens of the world and members of the Committee of Humankind. Now, it is precisely because the Treaty of Westphalia raised the curtain on the modern international law system that I have problems considering Suarez as a founding father of that system. Westphalia had established a system of international relations and international law which was exclusively concerned with interstate relations, and by exclusively, I mean that it failed to recognize and engage individuals as true subjects of international law, that is, as bearers of rights and obligations. For almost three centuries, individuals were practically invisible in the eyes of international law, and this exclusive state centricity, and I'm emphasizing exclusive state centricity, also found sustenance in philosophical underpinnings as varied as Hegelian idealism and classical legal positivism. I mean, I won't go into much detail about this, but put rather crudely, Hegel conceived of the state as the highest and total expression of individual, the Volksgeist, the unique spirit of the nation, which practically obliterated the individual personality of its components. This, in particular, runs counter to the ontological distinction I highlighted earlier in Suarez, between the whole and its parts, or the state and the individuals who compose it. This is the major distinction which we find in Suarez, but which then was completely removed in the Hegelian idea. Other legal theorists of the Romantic, or so-called Romantic period, that is the 19th century, such as Savigny, for example, spoke of the law itself as being based on the Volksgeist, the innate consciousness of a people emanating from custom. And of course, it would be really interesting to investigate the extent to which Savigny's idea on customary law, that customary law is the best kind of law, tallies or otherwise with the emphasis in Suarez on customary law. But that's something I haven't quite gone into yet. But as far as its application in international law is concerned, Hegelian idealism seemed to have won the day over Kant's idea of the jus cosmopoliticum, a law separate from national and international laws which considered the rights of both states and individuals, and which primarily valued individuals as holders of fundamental rights and as citizens of the world rather than of particular states. I mean, I'm quite interested in looking in how many of the early modern jus gentium theorists had actually prefigured the substance of what was later developed in Kant's idea of the jus cosmopoliticum, because it is not a coincidence, I think, that in recent years this idea, in a globalized context, has been taken up by a number of philosophers, like Derrida, for example, in his later works and in his political works, refers a lot to this Kantian idea of the jus cosmopoliticum, and so does someone like Martha Nussbaum. The extent to which this cosmopolitan approach has been taken up in the philosophy of international law, or whether it is desirable that international law should move towards this philosophy, will be something I hope to return to briefly soon in my concluding remarks. But besides Hegelian idealism, I said that the other sort of philosophical underpinning which seems to sustain the arrangement, the post-Westphalian arrangement, was classical legal positivism, which posited the reductionist account of legal validity based simply on the agreement by those bound by the law, with no reference to objective moral principles. And in this case, and in the case of international law, of course, the actors involved were states. So international law was created by states, and it was binding on states, not on individuals. By this account, too, individuals were left aside. So the Hegelian idea just obliterated the individual. The classical, the idea of in classical legal positivism, just in international law, I mean, right? Not legal legal positivism in general, in international law or applied to international law, just put the individuals aside. It is not a coincidence that after World War II, legal positivism came in the line of fire of those who accused it of legitimizing the atrocities that were committed, or even providing the legal basis for its justification. The most important post-World War II proponent of this tradition, H.L.A. Hart, went to great lengths to revise the classical notion of people like Austin, of legal positivism, in order to show how the thesis on the separation between law and morality, the basic thesis in legal positivism, did not imply or justify the gross infringements of human rights perpetrated during the war. Of course, it's quite interesting that the judge, I'll come back to him soon, the judge in the ICJ decision, in his separate opinion, relates what happened in this tomo in the Second World War to statism and what he calls the darkness of legal positivism. But in the immediate aftermath of World War II, there was a shared feeling about the inadequacy of the exclusively state-centric stance in international law, which strongly affirmed the principle of non-intervention and acted as a gatekeeper of immunities. The Nuremberg trials, for instance, inaugurated a new season which brought individuals responsible for crime to justice, thus giving individuals a standing in international law. In practice, however, there seemed to be a special focus on individuals as objects of regulation or bearers of responsibilities rather than as holders of rights. This emphasis on individual obligations with regards to international crimes could still be seen, for instance, in fairly recent years with the setting up of the International Criminal Court. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong in that, of course, but what I'm saying is that there's an imbalance on seeing individuals as bearers of obligations, of responsibilities under international law. Because even though, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which also came in the aftermath of the Second World War, was gradually enshrined in domestic laws and sustained the development in human rights law and international humanitarian law, it gave rise to legal institutions such as the European Court of Human Rights, etc. The enforceability of human rights of individuals under international law remains a far more problematic affair than bringing individuals to justice in relation to international crimes such as genocide, for example. While the very notion of legal personality in international law had changed dramatically since 1945, with individuals becoming explicitly subjects of international law, by and large, and this accounts for this imbalance, by and large, states still retain a complete monopoly over rights, obligations, and access. As Kate Barlett puts it, there still is a clear, I quote, differential treatment of states and individuals between active subjects and passive recipients of rights and obligations in the international legal system. Just as a side comment, it is, the fact that Barlett's book, The Individual in the International Legal System, published in 2001, remains one of the very first comprehensive accounts of the role of individuals in international law. I mean, it says a lot about the need for more scholarship to sustain the developments in international law will take place, inevitably. The main question that arises here is whether the current predominant status of individuals as passive recipients of rights and obligations, at least as decided by states, who construct international law, is sufficient to provide for the adequate access to individuals to justice. This is the subject on which the judge I referred to before, Cansado Trindade, actually wrote a book in which he argues that the right to access to justice is a right which belongs to the domain of the jus cogens, since it lies at the very basis of a legal system. Incidentally, in his dissenting opinion, with the final judgment of the ICJ case handed in February 2012, is very much based on the argument that, in his view, the court's majority, had failed to take into consideration the state of individuals as holders of rights, and therefore reduced a matter arising from the breach of fundamental rights to a consideration of state jurisdiction and immunity. This is his main criticism. Precisely that individuals did not have access to the to something that ultimately affected them and their claim, which had already been awarded. So, the judgment in the case concerning the jurisdictional immunities of states opposing Germany and Italy seems to prove the earlier observation that states still retain a complete monopoly over rights, obligations and access, and also shows that the issue of access to justice is an important test for assessing the role of individuals in the international legal system. In this case, it was clear that the ICJ's decision would affect directly individuals, that is, the families of the victims of the Dissimo massacre. Although they are, in a way, holders of rights and bearers of obligations under international law, their role in the international legal system was manifestly passive, in the particular case concerning them directly. While they could and did make recourse to domestic courts in Germany, in Greece, and in Italy, and even to regional courts such as the European Court of Human Rights, they could not intervene as individuals in the proceedings of a case which considered the jurisdiction of the courts before which they had previously appeared as litigating parties, but which ultimately had an effect on them because what was being challenged was the award of compensation to them. While Greece was allowed to intervene to inform the court on matters pertaining to or affecting its interests, the individuals concerned do not enjoy the rights to intervene under any provisions similar to Article 62 of the ICJ statute. Now, the situation, however, I think it's not so bleak. Because while ultimately the judgment seems to have failed to give individuals both formal and, of course, material access to justice due to international law as it stands, the order allowing Greece to intervene earlier in the proceedings, which is what I referred to at the beginning, may set an important standard for future jurisprudence. In his separate opinion, supporting the majority of judges in the order accepting Greece's request to intervene, Judge Cansado Trindade notes the following. This is a case which has a direct bearing on the evolution of international law in our times. There is no reason for keeping on overworking the rights of states while at the same time overlooking the rights of individuals. One and the other are meant to develop pari passu in our days. State immunity and the fundamental rights of the human person are not to exclude each other, and that would make immunity unacceptably tantamount, as that would make immunity unacceptably tantamount to impunity. I'm quoting from the judge, because this is part of contemporary jurisprudence, and the jurisprudence of the International Court of Justice, as you know, is not particularly old. So things are developing every year. He goes on to say that since the case in question had its origins in breaches of human rights and international humanitarian law, we cannot approach a matter like that of the jurisdictional immunities of states from a strictly interstate dimension. In the present proceedings before the court, that is related to the order, right, not to the judgment, consideration has been given to states as bearers of rights, as well as to individuals as bearers of rights. The judge argues that Greece was given the right to intervene even in virtue of the fact that it manifestly represented the interest of individuals concerned. Through the resurrection of intervention in present-day litigation, he says, after it had lay dormant in the Peace Palace, the headquarters of the ICJ, for most of the time of the court's history, it may come to justify the intervention in litigation, may come to satisfy the needs not only of states concerned, but of the individuals concerned as well, and ultimately of the international community as a whole, in the conceptual universe of the new jus gentium of our times, end quote. As the judge himself notes, our times does not quite seem to aspire to a world state. The civitas maxima gentium ruled by the jus gentium, Suarez might have thought about. But there seems to be, nonetheless, an aspiration to the effect of the construction of an international legal order applicable to both states and international organizations,
and to individuals pursuant to certain universal standards of justice. The fact that the case before the ICJ traces its origins to the Istanbul massacre shows not only how short the lapse of time between then and now is, but also how international legal institutions which have been established in the meantime operate within a framework of differential treatment of individuals and states in both substantive and procedural aspects of international law. This is not to say that the reconfiguration of the roles of states and individuals in the international legal system is not a continuously evolving process. It is indeed a process in which jurisprudence, understood both in its two senses as philosophy of law and also as case law, heavily contributes. The learned opinions expressed in judgments or opinions, whether supporting or dissenting, like the ones I have been mentioning, contain much that is of philosophical importance and goes to show why this area of inquiry falls within the domain of practical philosophy. Ultimately, the questions, the central questions on the legal personality of individuals in international law and on what constitutes true subjects of international law are philosophical questions which engage legal philosophers as well as jurists and practitioners in the field. And as I said in the sort of methodological premise I made earlier on when I quoted John Cottingham, this particular argument, or these arguments in international law, like any other philosophical argument, has a long history to it. If we ignore that tradition, the philosophical moves we make, which lie at the very basis of our practices, including court practices such as the ICJ's practices, may lead to potentially disastrous results. This is why I think that views such as those of Suarez, who very much considered both states and individuals as being at once safeguarded and bound by the jus gentium, can be quite enlightening. As I pointed out, the jus, which Suarez calls the proper object of justice, links justice, justitia, and the law, lex. Any law or legal system, including international law, then, is not quite fully a law if it lacks or limits the access to justice. And in international law, it is not only states that should have formal access to justice at international level, but also individuals. Without access, justice cannot be realized. Of course, the European Court of Human Rights is an excellent functioning example, but there is still much more to do. I think that it is also very important not to see these initiatives as a mere emancipation of individuals versus state centricity. Indeed, state centricity should not be taken simply in a pejorative manner, as long as, but this is the most important thing, as long as the rights of individuals are recognized, and this includes the right to access of individuals in international law, and their capacity enabled. In fact, I think that there is little benefit in continuing to oppose the individual and the state. So it doesn't make quite sense if we're saying much sense if we're saying that what the problem with the Westphalian system, which is still very present in some ways, was that it was exclusively state-centric, with absolutely no space for the individual. I mean, one can't quite imagine the need to oppose the individual and the state to the extent of somehow imagining that it's all about individuals. I mean, states do have an important role. But one can speak more of the role of the state in a more integrative way with the rights of individuals, of integrating the respective roles. I think this is that ultimately this is what political development in democratic societies is about. The democratic society based on the rule of law crystallizes the rights of individuals vis-à-vis the state, but it has not in any way made the state useless or removed anything from its sovereignty. If anything, it places the state at the service of the individual. And this is perhaps what states should be made more aware of when envisaging and constructing the international legal order. Rather than self-serving, the interests of states can and should take into account and enhance the role of individuals as true subjects of international law. I think that the possibilities for doing so have increased multifold through the reconfiguration in recent decades of the very notion, of the very idea of sovereignty in a landscape of increased regional and international cooperation, networking, and even, of course, integration of the whole process of globalization. Legal theory and international law should follow on this process, not only with respect to arrangements regulating relations between countries and groupings, but also with regards to where the individual stands vis-a-vis the state. In democracies, and I think this is important to keep in mind, much as it might sound obvious, in democracies, the increased recognition of the role of individuals and their active participation has not threatened the state. Though it, of course, has limited, I mean, if you think of the states in terms of the Volksgeist, then definitely. Right? Nor does it entail the erosion of a communitarian spirit. Though, of course, there is a risk that it might do so, but that's another issue. Speaking of democratization in international law might sound like a bit of a cliché, but if by democratization what I mean is increased active participation, and if I'm saying that the democratization of international law, I'm speaking of more active participation of individuals in the international legal system, that regulates the relations between states and individuals, I think it has worked quite well. Greater access, greater participation of individuals has worked quite well in domestic and regional legislation and juridical practice. There is no reason why the same initiatives should not be taken up to a higher level. There is enough experience, custom if you like, to push in that direction. After all, as Suarez reminds us, the legal customs of particular states lie at the basis of the jus gentium, and the same could apply to the jus gentium of our times. What we are looking at here goes beyond the resurrection, as the judge calls it, of the rights to intervene. We're looking at the renewed aspiration of an international legal order which the Westphalian system had effectively euthanized. At least some of the salient developments in international law and politics of the last 70 years or so have resurrected some of the key features of the early modern idea of the jus gentium, such as that formulated by Suarez, whose ideal of a universal community is actually, I think, being facilitated and made possible through the process of globalization and democratization. Even the more utopian formulations of the jus gentium, such as that formulated by Campanella, who I worked on, they have a distinct real side to them, or realist side to them, as goals that ought to be pursued. What was derided as utopian in the Westphalian frame of mind, which favored fragmentation over unity, seems today to be slightly more realizable. The idea of a world government in utopian writing, for instance, is not so much of a chimera. If we read those texts carefully, without the anti-utopian prejudice, what we are likely to find, what they really point towards, is something like world or international governance. And the idea of a world government and the world governance does have different connotations. One might not particularly aspire to having a world government, but the idea of world governance in a globalized context seems to be not only realizable, but even desirable. And if we're speaking of world governance, a strong legal order, a universal jurisprudence, Leibniz would have called it, which treats both states and individuals as its true subjects, is a fundamental component. More importantly, in resurrecting the early modern idea of the jus gentium, what is being recalled is that state sovereignty and individual rights can and should coexist. They should not be at loggerheads. The dovetail approach of 16th and 17th century philosophers, who admittedly lived in a very different world, still has a lot to teach us, I think, as we explore possible directions in international law. And this is why I thought that it was worth sort of commemorating the fourth centenary of Francisco Suarez's Tractatus de Legibus.
Well, thank you very much, Jean-Paul. You have raised so many issues here with regard to how we define the individual, how we define the state and their respective rights and powers. It seems to me like it's a very, very open field, a very, very open field, because we're trying to locate where power, not merely where power lies as between the individual and the state, but where it ought to lie. What I liked particularly was your comment toward the end, where you said that in the work of Suarez, justice as the basis for individual rights vis-a-vis state rights seems to give a ground for protecting the individual against the state. So it's not accepting individual rights as an ultimate position by any means. It's taking justice as the ultimate position, and a just order would enable individual rights to sometimes be protected, or for one state to sometimes intervene in another state. Is that what Suarez is saying?
Well, yes, pretty much. It's pretty much that. I mean, formulated more contemporary terms, that is, I think, in my reading of Suarez, at least, that is what he's saying.
Well, the only other comment I want to make now before passing on to the audience is, I am a bit surprised as well by your talk, because there is so much talk of human rights in the media, and there is such an emphasis in the West on the rights of the individual that it's almost surprising to find out that the current state of intellectual law, international law, is still very heavily oriented towards the right of states. So a whole social process of defining the rights of individuals still has to be developed and even completed. In international law, the rights are still very much with those of states. That's what worries me in what you're saying.
I think the international law has its two sides, the interstate law and, of course, the international human rights and humanitarian law, which, of course, still depend on states making those laws, which is why I said that states still have a monopoly over granting rights or recognizing rights and in a legal sense, and obligations. I think what is happening, or what might or should happen, is that these two areas, or these two understandings of international law, come closer together and are integrated better. I mean, I still think that's why I pointed this out, that not giving individuals access to justice at an international level is problematic, with all the talk of human rights, etc.
Well, I'm impelled to ask as well, when you look at some of the very recent serious international crises, like, for example, the American and British invasion of Iraq, the whole status of individual rights in the legality of that invasion, was this an issue? I mean, was there a sense in which the governments of Britain and the United States were claiming that they were undermining the sovereignty and attacking the territory of another state because of the need to defend individual rights? From what you said, if they were to make that argument, they would be far... It's a dangerous argument, but it's also an argument that wouldn't be considered in international law at the moment, where basically states are the key. Are the key individuals, the key legal individual is actually the state.
Well, no, actually, that argument, as far as I know, had actually been made. That is, defending and endorsed by the United Nations. How it was endorsed is another thing. But that's much older than recent cases. That is, the right to intervene. I mean, it has been accepted since the Vienna Conventions, probably even before the end of the 1800s. Of course, there have to be certain conditions which justify that intervention, or any other action. It doesn't have to be direct intervention. In the case of Libya, it wasn't direct, but it was in some ways it was direct intervention. But the idea was always that of deposing a tyrant who was repeatedly and seriously breaching the rights of individuals. The problem, I think, the real problem is more of, as we saw in the case of the United States, etc., the problem is that of unilateralism. of unilateralism.
I see.
That I think international law makes it quite clear that when intervention of this kind has to occur, it has to be through the by the international community. I mean, one of the disasters, in my personal view, of what happened in the war in Iraq, for example, was that the Security Council, the United Nations, was ridiculed by the unilateral approach of the United States. So, had the international community strongly felt that it should have intervened on the basis, then that would be the subject of discussion. But irrespective of how right or not they were, the unilateral approach, I think, goes absolutely against the idea that it is the international community as a whole that defends the right of individuals within states. It's not state A versus state B. And this is also, by the way, related to the early modern idea of different states forming an real international community. And it is always the community that acts to defend those individual rights.
Another question which occurred to me as I read this is that the very notion of individual human right is itself contested in societies in the world today, is it not? That is to say, some very large states with very large populations do not necessarily accept in any meaningful social sense the overriding rights of the individual to any particular thing or situation, whatever. I'm talking about countries like China, for example, but one could make cases as well for areas of Africa, I should think. So we are dealing here, aren't we, with very much a conception of the individual and of the rights of the individual taken from European culture. I don't know how this is impacting on arguments about the relative power of the state, the individual, and the international community. Has this come into discussions of the Jus Gentium yet?
Definitely, and I think much of the contemporary discussions, at least those I'm aware of, on whether human rights or individual rights are things that are there before they are declared by any country, or irrespective of whether a country acknowledges them or not, or whether they require the actual recognition in order to come into existence. Is a discussion that was present in the early modern idea of Jus Gentium. When I said that for Suarez, for example, and he wasn't the only one, the laws, the principle of the Jus Gentium, exist objectively before or prior to any explicit consent or declaration by a state. I think he was taking that position. On the other hand, he was very sensitive to the fact that when it comes to the enforceability then of those rights, and by consequence punishing the breaches of those rights, that invariably required the consensus, the consent of the country. And I think that sensitivity, he doesn't, because he can't give a solution to that, but I think the sensitivity he had more than many other theorists, I think, in his own time, to a problem that is still very much a problem today. I mean, the fact that, for example, have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is by definition universal, and it is by definition a declaration. It is not setting up anything; it is declaring something that it is acknowledging to be there. It in itself. It is not legally binding. Of course, what happened was that in many states, through their own legal systems, through their constitutions, etc., they have enshrined the principles, or lock, stock, and barrel, the Universal Declaration or the European Convention of Human Rights, into their legislation. Now, of course, if a state doesn't do that, the question is it bound by the principles of
the old question, isn't it?
It is really the old question.
Community and a state sovereignty. It's one of the oldest questions in international law.
Yeah. Because, and that is precisely the question that was in the debate. It's quite interesting to see how much of the debates in the 16th century, in the 17th century, for example, on this issue, are very similar in substance to the discussions after the Declaration of Human Rights on their enforceability, so on and so forth. I mean, of course, what the Universal Declaration is saying is taking as being human rights would fit into what in earlier times would have been called the natural law. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that many in the drafting of the Declaration were actually had a background in natural law theory. But when it comes to the enforceability, I think that is where the problem.
I'm beginning to see as well that one of the reasons why Suarez could advance the argument that there must be a certain balance between the rights of the individual and the rights of the state is precisely because he came from a natural law background. In other words, if you have a natural law background, that is to say there is some sort of universal intersocial accord about what the nature of people are, about what the nature of the person is. And that opens up possibilities for the protection of the individual because you're talking about an essential, universally shared definition of humanity, you see. It doesn't exist at the moment, but it that's a different avenue of trying to achieve the recognition of human rights via achieving an understanding of the natural personhood of all beings, of all human beings.
I definitely agree with that. Natural law has, for a number of reasons, been considered a bit of a, unfortunately, I'd say, a bit of a dirty word, precisely because it was it came to mean many different things.
It has very strongly Aquinas and Catholic orientation to it, or is that not the reason for it?
I think beyond its belonging to a Catholic or not Catholic understanding, I think the problem is that many of its advocates, in the course of its history, have used natural law to justify things which, according to at least certain readings of natural law, are completely unjustifiable. But on the other hand, I think that it's not a coincidence that over the past 70 years, because of what happened after the atrocities of World War II, because the competing legal theory, legal positivism, I mean, came in for a lot of criticism, I think new formulations of natural law have been put forward, perhaps not necessarily under that name, but with principles that can be shared with a natural law frame of mind, of course. But in natural law, one has to be very careful because even some of its advocates, as I said, have tended to attribute perhaps too much to natural law. I mean, just speaking, I think of the basic inviolable universal principles.
Well, I guess what I'm suggesting as well is that the question of answering the question about the balance between state sovereignty and individual right, as well as the question of international intervention to protect the rights of the individual, all of this would look like a different problem of enforcement were there a universally shared accord about the nature of human beings and the nature of the person. In a sense, if that existed, then there would be self-enforcement, if you follow me. But in the absence of that agreement, there issues arise as to how you control state, constrict individual states.
I mean, it's evidently very, very problematic. I think, just off the cuff, perhaps, and the reason why at the end I mentioned democratization, knowing, of course, and acknowledging that it could come across as a bit of a cliche, is precisely because of what the democratic process, in its ideal form, should do is to create a space for the dialogue, the exchange, which, well, might not resolve these problems, but I think, or at least I still hope, that it could give a clearer idea, and it could get people to somehow have or develop shared ideas on these. And I think that can influence things like, for example, the way the international legal order is constructed. But I wouldn't like to see an international legal order being constructed exclusively by states, even though formally it will always be constructed by states. It's always states who, through diplomacy, through political action, agree on the law. But I think that the more individuals participate and the more states are made to feel, as it should be, that they have obligations towards safeguarding people's interests, I think that can give slightly different shape to the future international legal order. And that would mean that people are actively participating, or can actively participating, even in not only in the legal order, but also in its construction and development. I mean, you started earlier your intervention by saying that where power is located. Of course, if there is no participation by people in what is going on, in what decisions are being taken when developing different areas in international law, then that would create a vacuum which would automatically, and not maliciously, be filled by the state, which is at the negotiating in the international forum. I think that if you have a stronger participation at that level, then there is a greater chance of individuals affecting those arrangements. And I think one of the natural result of that would be that individuals would expect to have access, for example, to those institutions in the international legal order.
I follow that. I think that's very interesting. It's like creating a space for individuals to participate should lead in the long run to, in fact, more constriction on states' self-definition of what they're going to do, and it would lead in the long run to more recognition of individual rights as, in fact, the decision which states make.
Exactly.
In fact, this is very
interesting. Well, states will still enjoy their prerogatives and their role, but that role would affect, or would reflect, rather, the needs, the requirements of individuals. I think that is what was interesting in that case, in the part of the case I discussed, where Greece was allowed to intervene, because it was allowed to intervene because it manifestly showed that it could also, besides defending its own legal interests and rights as a state, but also because of the consonance, in other words, the rights of individuals. But this is a bit of a one-off. But now it's part of jurisprudence, so it's, I think, quite interesting. So it is a matter of finding way, rather than putting. That's why I chose this title for the talk. It is a matter of, you know, avoiding this dichotomy, the putting individuals and states always at loggerheads. I think that requires a bit of more creative work and goodwill, which one can't always assume, of states and state interests and the usual international political process, etc., integrating better the needs and the rights of individuals. And I don't think, I mean, or I refuse to think that, you know, this is a particularly idealistic or utopian idea. I think that there is an environment which can slowly, gradually lead in that direction. And I'm definitely interested in seeing that is the direction that is taken.
What about civil disobedience, in the sense that you have the state and the individual, and there's an find a better word, an oppression of the state on the individual, when the individual disobeys against the state, civilly, legally, against the state, I mean, where did that flourish? Because when you were talking about Suarez, you said that it wasn't very common back then.
I think that what he refers to as the right, well, not he, what was the idea of the right to resist or depose, but even resist a tyrant, an oppressor, an oppressive government, was a long-standing tradition to that, and I think what we refer today as civil disobedience and all that is probably very similar to what he would have understood by resistance to authority.
From an individualistic point of view, one to the state.
Now, there were currents which justified disobedience, not obeying the law. That isn't very much in the natural tradition, on the grounds that the law is vexed, it's not really a law, it lacks the characteristics of justice, or that a particular order issued by a ruler was illegitimate because it went against the object of the good, which was, etc. I think the more, in brackets, individualistic approach to resistance emerged mainly in later political thought, with someone like Locke, for example. Suarez, I think, is very much of an intermediary between the two, even because of his, what I refer to as the contractarian principle, which is already quite clear in Suarez. Of course, the history of philosophy is always partial, so you always have the sort of the big names, and you always have philosophers who, for a number of reasons, which could be, you know, almost geographical reasons, make it into the canons. But I think someone like Suarez, for example, has a very clear contractarian principle, which is related to this right to resist. That is that, in some ways, the ruler would be breaching his. Of course, if we speak today of civil disobedience, the political circumstance and the political system is quite different. So it's there are big differences between speaking of civil disobedience in a democratic environment, for example, and the kind of environment he was writing about. But I think the principles are quite similar.
So you would say that civil disobedience is opposed to natural law in the sense...
No. But that it depends on what motivates and on it, whether it is justified or not. If it is justified, I mean, the whole natural law tradition justify certain cases.
In the sense that if you have a system, that there is a state, okay, that there is a form of civil disobedience going in that state, that well, the ruler is... is not abiding by the natural law in that case, would it be? Because it's unjust.
To really simplify something which I think is a bit more complex, in the natural law tradition, it was mainly based on the illegitimacy or the unjustness of an action or a law, whatever it is, and that is what would have justified action either on particular issues or the very presence of the ruler, if those actions were repeated and serious. In the later contractarian tradition, it was based more on something that was more clear. In Hobbes, it's the ruler had a very clear part in the contract to defend the subjects, citizens, against external invasion and against If he failed to provide that kind of security, or if he himself became a threat to the security individuals, then that's justified, this breach of the contract justified people resisting, even by taking up arms, for example, weapons. So the basis for justification is different, but I think there has always been some form of basis for the justification of civil disobedience. I mentioned an author who is not well known at all, like Bartolomeo de las Casas, who had a political role because he was the protector of the Indies, and later he became a Dominican and went there. And his apologetic work for the Indians is actually a defense of their rights to resist and oppose the colonizers because of the atrocities they were committed. So I think there's always been some kind of basis for defending the right to what you call civil disobedience, to resist, etc. But of course, in the history of political thought, there are the basis is different depending on what. But I don't think because I don't think that the idea of civil disobedience is excluded from the natural law tradition at all.
I worded it wrongly, in the sense that natural law, exactly, it is not excluded from the realm of moral law. On contrary, it is. It seems to
actually,
be.
I think sometimes you might also have a moral duty to resist.
Exactly, that's my point, in the sense that it seems to be sometimes a moral duty.
As long as it's justified.
Jean-Paul De Luca, thank you very much for a very interesting paper and discussion. Thank you.